guys, and welcome back to The Biblical Woman. Today, we're going to be talking about Habakkuk and just 9 lessons or encouragements that you can have from this Old Testament book. But before we jump into today's topic, I want to give a special thanks to Servants of Grace, Dave Jenkins, for being on our last episode. If you missed it, go listen to it. We talked about why Christians should study the Old Testament. Because a lot of the times I hear people say, well, I'm a New Testament only Christian, or we're a New Testament only church. Dave helped us break down some of those ideas and why Christians should study the Old Testament. And we just don't get to pick one half of the Bible to read and the other half to ignore. The Old Testament is just full of spiritual treasures that are so applicable for Christians. We are going to be talking about Habakkuk today, and it has been very requested that we keep doing Old Testament books. You guys absolutely love them. So we are going to continue working through these books. Personally, I found this book interesting because I graduated college, oh my goodness, almost a year ago now. But one of the questions I heard constantly on campus would be, well, you know, why does God allow evil? Why is there suffering? If God is so good, you know, why do all these bad things happen? And what's so interesting about this book is that within the first 4 verses, Habakkuk is asking God the exact same questions. His wording's a little bit different, but he is asking God those same questions. And so this book is going to help us address those types of questions.
Yeah, and I love this. And again, it just shows there is nothing new under the sun. Habakkuk was written approximately 500, 600 years before Christ.
It was written, I think, before Lamentations, if I'm correct.
Yes, yes.
That's a long time ago, and people were asking those questions too. But let's jump into some interesting facts about this book, because it's a good one.
Yes.
And one of the things that separates this prophet book from the other ones is that it's not directly addressed to the people. You know, this is Habakkuk having a conversation with God. He's asking him questions and God is answering him. Mm-hmm. That's very different because with a lot of the other books, we see that God is addressing his people through the prophet.
Yes, and I love this format because it does make it deeply personal. It looks very much like a conversation that we've probably all had at some point in time with God.
To me, that style was very interesting in this book because I don't feel like it's in a lot of the other minor prophets.
Right, right. And I think it just makes it all that more personal. Very much like a conversation we have today with God.
There's so many elements of poetry within this book. There's the parallel sentence structures, there's metaphors, there's similes, there's personification. Just the imagery is amazing, especially within the 3rd chapter. When we get there, I will tell you guys why I love the imagery of the 3rd chapter.
Ooh, I'm excited for that.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is so good.
Yeah. And maybe we'll talk more about this in chapter 3, but chapter 3 is kind of this theophanic vision. And I recently just learned what a theophany is. It's a visible manifestation of God to man. And this is a complete aside, but if you guys subscribe to Renewing Your Mind podcast by R.C. Sproul, I just a few weeks ago listened to his sermon entitled Jesus Walking on Water, and he fully explains just more in awesome detail about what a theophany actually is. So that's a great resource if you're curious more about that.
Yeah, and I, reading through our notes as you and I were doing this as a Bible study, I had never heard of that either. So I'm like, oh, this is so good. This book also influenced a lot of the forefathers of the Reformation, like Luther and Calvin.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool as well.
Nicole, what is the context of this book?
Okay, so the context is that this took place during Jehoiakim's reign, which again was approximately 609 to maybe 598 BC. So again, it was before the Book of Lamentations. And if you guys missed that episode, go back and check out our Lamentations episode. But so yes, this was before the rise of the Babylonians. And yeah, so this is prior to that period of time. But we see again a consistent theme in the Old Testament of the society in Judah was just dominated by wickedness. And the people were rejecting God's covenant. And this happened time and time and time again. And so this is the context and the setup for Habakkuk's conversation with God.
So let's go ahead and jump into chapter one. As we go through each of these individual chapters, we are going to read them to you guys. That way you know what we are talking about. Let's go ahead and read chapter one. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. Verse 2, and I'm just going to throw this little commentary in there. Verse 2 is the start of his question to God. Verse 2, O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. For the wicked have surrounded the righteous, and so justice goes forth perverted. Verse 5, God answers him, look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go from them. Their horses are swifter than lions, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence, all their faces forward. They gather captives like sand. At the kings they scoff, at the rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. Then they sweep like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God. And then verse 12, Habakkuk gives a second question or a second complaint. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, have you not ordained them as a judgment? And you, O rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like the crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook and he drags them out with his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet, and so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury. His food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? And I'm going to read verse 1 from chapter 2 just to finish it out. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. So chapter one, we see Habakkuk ask God this question and then God answers. And then Habakkuk asks again, beginning of chapter two, he is waiting for God's response to his second question.
Yeah. And his question at the very beginning, again, is similar to ours even today, as we look around our wicked world and all the craziness that's happening in our country. And like Habakkuk, we know that God is good and just, but sometimes we wonder, why does he allow violence, corruption, disobedience? Like, why does he allow this? And it seems as though the wicked go unpunished. And so Habakkuk's question to God is certainly our own. Why does he allow us to see this evil? And why does it seem to go unpunished?
Well, and I think that, you know, God allows us to see the evil and the sin within ourselves to, one, keep us humble, and two, show us where we need to make growth as individuals to become more Christ-like. It's to help us value our salvation more.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point with all of this, because I think when we do see the wickedness both in ourselves and in the world, it does make us more grateful that God provided a way for us to be saved.
I think he allows us to see the sinfulness in others, to praise him for his grace when he does save sinners. I think it can also be to help motivate us to build God's kingdom by sharing the gospel.
That's how we should be responding. That should be our thought and our prayer when we see wickedness. Okay, what can I do to share the gospel? How can I make him known?
Absolutely. In verses 5 through 11, we see God's response to his first question. God is not blind to all the corruption, the sinfulness, the wickedness, the evil of the world. Like, God sees that it is going on. But then he even goes a step further and saying, like, hey, I'm raising up this foreign nation to judge Israel.
I love verse 5. It is my favorite of the entire book, because God is basically saying to Habakkuk, hey, I've got this. I am doing something. And if I told you, you wouldn't even believe me. And I just love that.
I do too, because I think a lot of the times we want to know what God is doing right this second, and sometimes we just don't get that answer. I think it's interesting, as we look at verses 12 through the beginning of chapter 2, we see Habakkuk's second question after God answers him the first time. And he can't understand, like, why God is bringing in this other nation, because they represent everything that God hates. His questions of, like, you cannot look at wrong. Why do you look idly at traitors? Why do you remain silent when the wicked swallow up the righteous? He's struggling here.
Yeah, he doesn't like this answer from God, because he's like, wait, what? This is even worse. What are you doing?
I think it's a very human response. Like, I think in the same situation, all of us would probably respond in the same way or something similar.
Yeah. Like, we cannot see what God's doing. So to us, it looks like, okay, this doesn't seem like it's going to fix anything. But ultimately, as we'll see, God has his purpose.
Absolutely. And he's struggling to understand, because he knows God's character. And I think that's what his questions reveal. Like, he understands God's justice and his goodness. But as we progress through this book, you're going to see that by the end, it is because he knows God's character that he is able to trust and rely on God.
Right. So let's go ahead and look at chapter 2 and see the Lord's response to Habakkuk's second complaint. So I'm going to pick it up in verse 2 of chapter 2. And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects at his own all peoples. And so it goes on to say a woe to the Chaldeans in verse 6. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long, and loads himself with pledges? Will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the peoples shall plunder you, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off your peoples. You have forfeited your life, for the stone will cry out from the wall and the beam from the woodwork respond. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, it is not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire, and nations weary themselves for nothing. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beast that terrified them. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it, a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver. There is no breath in it at all. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him.
Yeah, so chapter two, for the most part, is God replying to Habakkuk as he's standing on the watchtower. I love that last little bit there where it says to let all the earth keep silence before the Lord as he sits in his holy temple. Like, that's just very powerful imagery.
Right. The ESV study Bible that I use, it had a commentary on that specific verse. And I'm just going to say that quote from it. This was not from me, but from, like I said, my study Bible. And I loved it. It said, all of the woes culminate in the universal silence of worship and the glorious presence of the incomparable God, which I loved that. That is what those woes come to. But given the sinful state of Babylon, all nations will become her, as these five woes can apply to any nation. We're going to talk about those real quickly because we see these even in our own country. And I think it's important to just realize once again that what the people of Israel were doing when they turned their back on God and his covenant are the same things that still occur today.
The five woes, we see the injustice in the economy, and God actually dedicates two of the woes to the injustice in the economy. Then the third one is human injustice. Four is the woe of alcohol abuse. And five is idolatry. And just like Nicole said, we could take these five woes and really apply them to any nation. Any nation could be Babylon from these five woes.
Right. It says in there, you know, that their glory will be their shame, you know, that they were seeking their own glory. They were not seeking God's glory in any of this. And we see God's response to that at the end of the chapter. Like we said, it culminates in worship of him. I love even in verses 13 and 14, we see again God's sovereignty in all things and the glory of God in all things. Verse 14 says, not just the temple or tabernacle will be filled with God's glory, but the whole earth will be filled with God's glory.
Well, looking back, because we have the full Bible, as Christians, we can look back and see that. Like you said, I think it's very interesting that it's not just the temple or the tabernacle, but it is the whole earth that he will reign in.
Yeah. In verse 16, the cup of the Lord's hand is divine retribution. He is the judge. We know there will, you know, we want to see justice done on this earth, of course, but sometimes that we don't always see that. And we just have to wait and be patient because we know that in the end, God's justice will prevail.
Absolutely. And I think that that is so encouraging for believers. But in this chapter, we learn that one, the earth is going to be filled with God's glory, and he does it all for his glory. 2, we learn that God calls us to exercise our faith in him. And as we go back to the beginning of chapter 2, we see that the righteous shall live by faith. Mm-hmm. And Paul actually uses verse 4 from this chapter as a foundational text for his proclamation of the gospel.
Yeah, which is really cool. And we see this too, even in Abraham, you know, his faith was credited to him as righteousness. So yeah, absolutely. It is a call to exercise faith in God.
And then point number 3 is that God's justice will be done, and that should lead us to worship him. Those are, I think, 3 important points that we can take away from chapter 2.
So then moving into chapter 3, this is where we'll see the theophany that we mentioned at the beginning of the episode. And this is Habakkuk's prayer. Like you were saying, I'm so curious to hear what you've got to say on this, Kat, because I know you talked about just the imagery that you loved. So
yeah,
go ahead.
Okay. So a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet. O Lord, I have heard the report of you and your work, O Lord, I do fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers? Or was your indignation against the sea? When you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation, you stripped the sheath from your bow. Calling for many arrows, you split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and the moon stood still in their place. At the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear, you marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in your anger. You went out for the salvation of your people. For the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the head of his warriors. You came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. I hear my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones, and my legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will wait quietly for the day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us. 17 through 19 is the ending of this book. So here we go. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor the fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's and makes me tread on my high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments. I'm just going to go ahead and say this. One of my favorite parts about that chapter was the warrior imagery that the prophet uses to describe God. If you could look at my Bible, you would see all the different colors that I use to mark everything. But talking about riding on chariots, the chariot of salvation, bows and arrows, a glittering spear, marching through the earth, trampling the sea. There's just so much imagery of God being a warrior against the evil ones.
That is so comforting and such a picture of his justice. You know, like he has to act in accordance to his character, and the wicked will be brought to the consequence that he has for them. And I think this also is really cool because we see this in Jesus too. And Revelation describes Jesus, like what, you know, the rider on the white horse, and that he's coming with a sword, and on his thigh is written King of Kings and Lord of Lords on his thigh and on his robe. And again, I think that is awesome because it goes back to even this imagery of God as the warrior, like that's who he is.
Absolutely. This is not my original idea, but verses 8 through 15 show us the future, I'm going to call it the future Exodus. And like I said, this is not my original idea. When I was studying, this comes from the Bible Project. And as you read chapter 3, remember the events of Exodus, of Pharaoh and Moses and the Red Sea. This section of verses 8 through 15 is like the future Exodus. It is the future defeat of evil. And when it mentions Pharaoh is like an archetype for evil nations. And just as God brought judgment to Pharaoh, he will do so with all evil. And God is going to save his church, save his people, just as he did the Israelites when Pharaoh came to re-enslave them. Verse 13, it points forward to Christ saving his bride and destroying evil, crushing the head of the house of wicked. It just points forward to Christ and what we can look forward to as believers.
Yeah. And just again, to reiterate some of the things that we talked about in the prior podcast with Dave, that the whole Bible, every book in the Old Testament does point forward to Christ. I wish I knew that earlier in my life than I did, but I'm sure glad I know it now because it makes studying these Old Testament books just all that more exciting and, I don't know, just so awesome. So I love that we see Christ in Habakkuk.
I think that is just so encouraging. I'm going to say this. I think that if you are somebody who needs a little bit of extra evidence that salvation and Christ dying on the cross wasn't a backup plan, I think that Habakkuk definitely is evidence for that. Like God had planned this in eternity past, that Christ would save his people and destroy evil. But at the end of the book, we see Habakkuk rejoicing because he knows who God is. He knows that God is faithful, even in judgment, that God is going to keep his word and his justice is never going to overpower his mercy or vice versa. And Habakkuk knows that he can trust God to bring about this future salvation for his people. An important lesson from this section is that Habakkuk teaches us to persevere in hope and have confidence in the Lord fulfilling his unfailing promises. Because if God makes a promise, we know that we can count on it. And that should give us hope and cause us to persevere. And that's another important lesson from this book.
Everything you just said is the source of Habakkuk's joy. He's basically saying, like, listen, even if like all of that perishes or there's none of, you know, the crops don't, you know, succeed, kind of reminds me, and he says, you know, I've learned the secret of being, it doesn't matter, you know, if I'm living in plenty or in want, I have Christ and I can do all things.
That's just such an amazing point. I mean, because like you said, he's talking about livelihood. He's talking about having food to see that no matter what his situation is, that he is going to trust God. Some more important points or lessons that we can take away from this chapter. God has shown us all throughout history who he is. When you read the Bible, you will see this. When you study church history, you will see this. He gives his word to us as a reminder of how faithful he has been to us and just who he is.
And we see Habakkuk's response to this when he talks about that he is trembling. I hear and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound. That's his response to who God is. And that should be ours too, this reverent awe and wonder and fear.
Another important point, I think, from this chapter is that you had just brought this up, like we are most satisfied and we have the most amount of peace when we are completely dependent on God, just like Habakkuk, when he is saying, like, even if there's no food, even if there's no way for us to make a livelihood to survive, we are still going to be rejoicing as we depend upon God. And that is another important lesson from this chapter. And then finally, the last important point that we've already touched on is that God will defeat evil and save his people. Like, that is the outcome that we have to look forward to. That in itself is just beyond encouraging for us.
See that within the whole Bible, the connection to this, like we've mentioned already, is that the cross and the final judgment are fulfillments of this revelation.
You're right. That is the whole Bible connection. That's, to me, just why I love chapter 3 so much, is because that warrior imagery of God plays into showing us the final judgment of Christ defeating evil and saving us, saving his people. We can have such great hope in this. And I loved this book.
Yeah, me too. It was great. I've read it because in the past I did the Read the Bible in a Year plan, but it had been a while and I definitely liked taking the time to really go through it at a slower pace.
I think when we slow down and really just dive into scripture, you know, verse by verse, chapter by chapter, there's just so many things, so many spiritual treasures we can find. And I wish I could like show you guys my Bible and the pages that were once like, well, my pages are cream colored, but it looks like a rainbow now. Because that's just how I journal in my Bible. But when we slow down and really just pick apart every single verse, there's so much that we will discover. And because Nicole and I covered so many important things, I'm just going to run through what these lessons or encouragements are for modern believers from this book. So here we go. God calls us to exercise our faith in him. 2, he does everything for his glory, and the earth will be filled with his glory. 3, God's justice will be done, and this should lead us to worship him. 4, he teaches us to persevere in hope, and we can have confidence in his promise because God is faithful. 5, he has shown us all throughout history who he is, and he gives us his word as a reminder of this. 6, the presence of God should cause us to tremble. It should remind us of who he is. And 7, we are most satisfied and at peace when we are completely dependent on God. And then 8, God will defeat evil and save his people. And that is what we have to look forward to as Christians. I'm going to say this as point number 9 or lesson number 9 from this episode, is that knowing that this is the outcome, that God will defeat evil and save his people, that should motivate you to go share the gospel with someone. Thank you guys so much for listening. Stay tuned for our upcoming episodes. We have so many great topics picked out, amazing people for interviews lined up. Be sure to check those out. But I'm going to go ahead and close us out with a benediction from Philippians 4, 6, and 7. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Jesus Christ.